So I was probably, like, you could argue, uncool at that time in an era where everything was like more is more. I was like, no, no, less is less. And this is how to make it really easy. I don't believe I've ever sat there and said, I'm so clear on this myself, so let's go. My whole mantra is like, it'll be grand, sure, why not? So it was more like, but of course I'll give it a shot. Sure, what's the worst that can happen? Rather than saying, I have sat here and prepared a plan for the next 5 years, so I know every intricate detail. No, I still don't. I'm like, I should give it a go. Do you know? Yeah. And thankfully it worked out. The number one difference between someone who becomes an entrepreneur and someone who doesn't is the entrepreneur knows that they don't know everything, but they're not scared of that.
Today, my guest is Amy Connolly, the visionary behind the brand Sculpted by Amy, the makeup and beauty brand taking the world by storm. Here's my chat with Amy. It takes courage and belief in yourself and your business idea to take the step to set up your own business. In the early stages, entrepreneurship can be a lonely road, even through those milestone moments. Deciding to commit to the idea you've been mulling over, learning, growing, and developing your skills, building a team to help you along the way, preparing to launch into new markets. Enterprise Ireland is there for all of those startup moments. From providing advice and guidance to new founders through our startup network, to pre-seed funding and early investment, we're here to help bring your ambition to fruition. To find out how Enterprise Ireland can help you on your startup journey, visit enterprise-ireland.com. Before we dive into today's episode, I want to share a game changer for your business, Azure Communications. When it comes to print and marketing solutions, these folks, led by CEO Jenny Johnston, are the real deal. Whether you need an eye-catching brochure, sleek business cards, or a full-blown digital campaign, Azure Communications has you covered. They're not just about high-quality prints or digital campaigns, they're also about delivering great results. And here's the best part. Just for listeners of the Entrepreneur Experiment, you can get 20% off your first order. Just give them a call or go online and use the code FOX20. With personalized service and fast turnaround times, Azure Communications will help you make the impact your business deserves. Trust me, when it comes to making your brand stand out, Azure Communications is the provider of choice. Check them out at azurecom.ie, use code FOX20, and elevate your marketing game today. Nostra, an Irish IT company, offers world-class managed IT services, cloud solutions, IT support, and more, all tailored to meet your business needs. Whether you're streamlining operations or boosting productivity, their expert team is ready to help. Visit nostra.ie or email info@nostra.ie to see how they can solve your IT challenges today. Amy, welcome to the pod.
Hello, thank you so much for having me.
It is a pleasure to have you in studio. I saw you at Ecom Live. Our paths had crossed various times, but I saw you at Ecom Live and I was like, I have to have Amy on the pod. So I finally got you. Welcome. You are the name on everyone's lips at the minute in Ireland. Your growth has been exceptional.
Yeah. Do you know what? It's so funny. It's obviously, first and foremost, so lovely to hear that. But I don't think you ever get accustomed to it. So you just feel like you kind of want to die inside of it.
Really?
Yeah. You're like, oh, cringe. But in the nicest way possible. Because I just feel like, you know, again, not that I am ungrateful for the success or that I take it for granted. I'm eyeing the pulse of the next thing. So I never sit back and be like, yeah, you're right, Gary. Actually, I am on everyone's lips, haven't I?
It's just, I know, not in me. It's a very un-Irish thing to do, like to go, well, thank you. And will I tell you some more cool stuff about me? And I think that's, we had a brief chat outside, and I think that's part of the entrepreneur makeup, isn't it? It's always like the next. What got you here is this drive. Where do you reckon that drive comes from?
I think it is something that's actually been like inherently in me. It definitely would come, I would say, from my mom. And I've only really come to that thought, no offense to my lovely mother, when I've been pressed to think about it over the last, say, 5 years in interviews. You know, you kind of take for granted this is your makeup, and I did, excuse the pun on makeup, I mean your actual makeup self. And I went into business straight from college, and I did beauty straight out of school. So it was all just kind of like, this is just the pathway. This just happened. But actually, when you think back and you're forced to reflect, my mom was a single mom, was super hardworking, always was on to the next thing, left pharmaceuticals in her 40s, decided to study property and set up her own business, like would never take no for an answer. So that drive definitely got passed on to me. Also being an only child, I think you're forced to be a bit more independent probably. But I think it was definitely my mom. And even like, again, like I said, being forced to reflect back, I was the kid who was like selling lemonade that I made up with flowers in the garden. Not just trying to make a quick buck, but trying to be like, how could I do something with this here? And that obviously followed me through when I decided to study business in the end. But yeah, I would say it comes from that kind of upbringing.
I've talked about this loads on the pod, and I always ask everyone that question because more, I'd say 95%, it's been mum, dad, uncle, cousin, brother, sister. And I say it all the time. I'd say people are sick of it going, you have to see it to be it.
Yeah.
And at the time, you mightn't kind of go, oh yeah, I see it now and I'm going to be it. It's that inherent thing. It's so interesting about the kid when you're, I did that as well. Mm. And anytime I see kids doing that, I'm like, oh, here, I'll buy like five of them and six of them because I love it. But isn't it so interesting that inherent, like you're not doing it to make money. Obviously, people set up side hustles now. It's usually to make money. Yeah. When you're a kid, you're like, I'm just going to do it.
Totally. Now, I would also argue on the side hustle part, don't get me wrong, no business can function without making money. So I caveat before saying that. But I fundamentally think if you're only going into something to make money, it's doomed.
Mm.
I think like there is so much more to it now. We spend so much of our lives working that regardless whether you're an entrepreneur or entrepreneur, like you have to really feel the purpose of it beyond the financials.
Yeah. And it's finding that sweet spot between, you know, purpose and profit.
Yeah.
You need both. Trying to find that sweet spot, right? Because sometimes people are too purpose-driven and they forget about like, oh yeah, that.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, okay, you probably have to sell it for a little bit more than a fiver. So it's interesting. So what you kind of alluded to your path there. So after school, into college to study business?
Yeah, I studied business in French, but I had been working in makeup part-time since I was 16. So it was like my part-time job whilst in school, did my leaving cert. Went on to do study. So I was always like completely study driven. In as much as I adored my financial dependence of my part-time job, I actually fell in love with beauty. Wasn't expecting to fall into that world. I knew I wanted to go on to college because I was so geared up for whatever my degree would be. And that ended up being business and French.
Okay. Yeah. And at what point did you kind of go, huh, that actually might be a career. The thing I'm doing on a Saturday might actually be the thing I do every day.
When I was like 18 or 19, I started working for myself. So I left Counter, which would have been my Saturday, Sunday part-time job, and started doing freelance or really enjoyed the theory of teaching people and educating. I actually would have loved to have been a primary school teacher had I not gone the business route. So at that stage, being able to mix in my love of beauty and teaching humans to do it was great. So I was renting like hotel rooms when I was like 19 to 21. So I kind of, it's not that I sat down and said, oh, this is going to be my business. It was more that I was just like, why would I work for anyone else when I've been working for myself since I was 19?
Mm.
So when I watched all my peers when I was graduating, you know, do the graduate programs and fill out all the docs that were needed, there wasn't one being in me that was like, oh, I wonder, should I do that? It was like, okay, cool. So I'm at a stage now where I've been doing makeup for 6 years. I've been very lucky to have such a breadth of different parts of the industry, from writing beauty, being on TV with beauty, physically doing beauty at shoots. What's the next level up for this? So I decided, let's mix it with business and let's start a brand.
Wow. So you never had any consideration. That's interesting though, because you were study driven to college.
Totally.
But then you knew.
Like if I didn't get all A's, don't speak to me. Like, and it's so funny because my mom often feels guilty. She's like, I didn't put that pressure on you, but I was always like that.
That's really interesting. Because a lot of entrepreneurs are kind of like, did school because I kind of did school, and then I did college because I kind of did college, but I had no real, I just did it to do it.
Yeah.
Whereas you were very driven to do it, but it wasn't the end.
No. And I think it's probably more so reflective of the pressure, maybe is the best word, that I would put on myself. So like this expectation of how I need to achieve or succeed. But as much as I adored college and I would never change it, I knew that I was going to just do my own thing. But you could say the business served me well. Do I think back to a certain lecture these days and think, that really taught me well in this situation? No, but it was an amazing time in my life and I loved the experience.
Yeah, I did the same. I did business. And then when I think back, I'm like, oh, what would I like my daughter to do? I'm like, I don't know if I learned lots or now I just know it because I learned it.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of way. I think, yeah, I think the college experience is good.
Yeah.
I think it definitely gives you a grounding and learning and more so like social skills and totally. Things like that.
And you make friends for life with that group as well. Mm.
And then talk to me, were you making enough money to survive at that stage? Were you like, was it kind of a logical choice because you're like, well, I'm earning X, so I've already have my wage here?
No, it was all quite close to the next paycheck, I would say, particularly when you're freelance or, you know, a contractor in these days, everyone will know you're kind of only surviving till your next job, your next paycheck. And, you know, being totally honest, like me getting into work at such a young age, at 16, not such a young age, at the age that I physically could, was as much as something I wanted to do for my own independence in as much as my mom needed me to, because, you know, it was just me and her. She was hit badly by the recession at the time, like a lot of families were. So we weren't badly off and I've had, you know, privileged upbringing. But at the same time, it was like, I need you to help me out here because I can't, you know, afford it for both of us. So,
What did that feel like then as a 16-year-old?
It felt brilliant because not only did my part-time job allow me a certain level of independence, it massively worked on my confidence and all of those other skills that come with working in a public space. But I will say that I definitely was very conscious of never having money, so or of ever running out of money. So like debt for me was like a no-go. Like if I remember taking a loan out to buy my first car, had it paid back before the deadline, well in advance, because it was like, I just need that cleared. But it also made me really disciplined with money. So when I was investing in myself and the business, and albeit a smaller amount at the time, I was very clear on the 10 grand that I invested in the first stock order, making sure that I sweated that where I only pulled down certain amount of levels when I was needed or when they were needed, rather than doing it all and having no grasp on things. Because the number one thing when you're self-funded is you have to be all over your cash flow. And if you're not, it's game over. You can be the best in the business with the best idea in the world, not making money if you run out, it's gone. And that's the really sad ending. So I think actually, you know, being forced to kind of go into the workforce out of a necessity and not just a need to grow, and then also managing my own money from a young age, like I'm not saying relatively like your part-time salary, do you know, but like managing my social life and what I wanted to buy or keeping my car up and your tax and insurance and all that, was a really good learning, but also reflective of the fact that I definitely do not like being in debt and that fear around it.
It is a great learning though, because it's your first experience of, okay, I have 200 quid. Where does that go?
Yeah.
And like, it seems almost too basic now, but it's the same in business.
Yeah.
Like you have 200 grand. Okay, that has to go here, 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 and here. I think there's always a big difference. I always see a big difference between entrepreneurs who've been funded early and entrepreneurs who've bootstrapped.
Okay.
There's a very different mindset as to like yourself, that you know straight away, it was 10 grand.
Yeah.
I knew exactly where that was going to go. And I knew that like, there's a rigor and a discipline to bootstrapped entrepreneurs that's really unique.
Yeah. And I think it's really important. I think like, not only does it make you disciplined to make sure your cash is coming in, it makes you disciplined in every way of thinking. So like in marketing, you could literally wash money down the sink when it comes to marketing if you're not on it. Whereas you have to think outside the box of nearly like, what can I do for free here if you don't have the cash to play up like you do at the start versus others?
And then you graduated college. What was the first step? That's always the one I love. That 0 to 1. I'm obsessed with that first 0 to 1.
The literal first step I did was I Googled European makeup manufacturers. So I knew, firstly, I knew that I wanted to merge business and beauty, and the most logical way was doing a brand. I was fascinated by product. I'd worked on counters for like 6 years. I had a big kit. I loved texture. I was very lucky to do like all ages when it came to faces. So the product was a non-negotiable for me. That I knew inside and out. I knew exactly what I wanted.
And you knew you wanted to build your own product.
I did. And I also knew that staying in Europe was safer regulations wise, because as much as I knew about the end formula, I didn't know about the physical making of it in terms of the regulations and certifications. Hence Googling European manufacturers. And I would say I sent about 25 emails. I got about 22, just no acknowledgements, like inbox, got my email and just, you know, nothing came back. Totally fair. I got 2 that said no. And I got 1 that said, okay, we'll hear you out and have a meeting. And I hopped on a plane to Manchester 4 days later. And I was like, cool, I'll be there on Friday. Thanks so much for accepting my invite before you can change your mind. So that was the kind of step one. That was finding a supplier that could actually realize this with me, I suppose.
And what was your vision?
My vision was always centered around, probably from being a makeup tutor before a makeup brand founder, that was making it easy. You have to remember, like 8 or 9 years ago, we were in a world where, particularly in beauty, it was centered around a 62-minute YouTube tutorial that you would watch with like 17 tools, 5 foundations, 4 concealers, and you would contour, for example, like a Kim Kardashian, and you'd be done. And I was like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Firstly, you do not need that many products. You do not need that much time. And I was fascinated by like tiny little tweaks that you could do with either the brush placement or the type of color that you use or the type of product that you use could make the biggest difference. So I was probably like, you could argue, uncool at that time in an era where everything was like more is more. I was like, no, no, less is less. And this is how to make it really easy. So I loved that simplification. I loved that ethos of like sculpting your own look and your own face of how you feel comfortable wearing, because essentially that's what beauty is. It's a confidence booster in whatever way we want it to be for ourselves. So that was very much in my original idea for the product. So I had 2 products at the beginning. One was a trio palette that you would use in your cheek and your eyes, so double up where you can. And then one was a double-ended brush that wasn't just like this random applicator tool that I was selling on as an add-on. It was a physical shape that I believed you could fit right into your cheekbone and it would do the work for you. So it was a very purposeful addition to the palette. And again, multi-purpose, so that kind of dual element that you'll see still to this day running through our products. But outside of it being like a, I felt this product was missing, it was more that I felt a more concentrated version of products was missing, and like simplifying it like in a kit for someone rather than saying, you know, they used to come into me on counter when I worked for other brands at the time when I was like 16 or 17. Hi, I'm looking for a powder. And I'd be like, no problem. Here's 72 options we have. So they'd be like, you can see the birds swinging over their heads, do you know? So just really trying to break it down and make it easy. And genuinely to this day, that's like one of our center points.
It's so interesting though, when you explain your journey there of like working on the counters. And so you said something there really interesting, all ages and all types.
Yeah.
And how that then shapes the insight. Like no experience is wasted if you put it to use, right? So obviously you'd all, I love the idea of doing your reps. Like you were working every Saturday on the counter, probably like back-breaking work.
Totally.
Some of it like probably hard. I'm sure you met some characters, but it was leading you to that, like just that muscle memory of like, well, no, I've done this 1,000 times. And what you actually need is this. So you had such a clear vision. Where did the confidence come from? Because we kind of touched on this earlier. Where did the confidence come from to go to the manufacturer and go, this is exactly what I want?
Do you know what? I ask myself that a lot sometimes as well. I nearly wish I kept a journal at the time where I could read back on my thoughts, because don't get me wrong, starting my part-time job at 16 really helped my confidence. Do you know, I wouldn't say that I was like this terribly shy kid, but like was definitely not super confident. So working in that space really helped develop me. And I always remember my uncle saying that to me, that my confidence grew so much in those kind of first 2 years on counter when you're dealing with customers. The actual confidence to send the email, I don't believe I've ever sat there and said, I'm so clear on this myself, so let's go. My whole mantra is like, it'll be grand, sure, why not? So it was more like, but of course I'll give it a shot. Sure, what's the worst that can happen? Rather than saying, I have sat here and prepared a plan for the next 5 years, so I know every intricate detail. No, I still don't. I'm like, I should give it a go. Do you know? Yeah. And thankfully it worked out.
It's trying to find that sweet spot, isn't it? Because like, I'm trying to find like formulas that each founder has. Like mass faction is kind of the one I keep coming back to. You know, they'll plan to a point, but they all take massive action. It's like you send those emails. You're not sitting there going, oh, I'll just do 10 more and I'll just do this and I'll do more slides. All the great founders I've spoken to would just take loads of action.
Yeah.
They just keep hammering forward.
But break it down. Like there's nothing more overwhelming than looking at the top of a mountain saying, oh my God, I have to leap there. Like I am a firm believer that everything in business and in life is small, continuous steps. So like, say for example, a massive launch for us. I would still get overwhelmed if I thought about that end goal without thinking about the steps there. If I can break down 10 things, and it's not only that you're breaking it down to be more piecemeal to get there, you're also allowing yourself to feel some fulfillment that you're ticking things off as you go. So you don't feel like you're just circling in the same spot. Now, at the time, did I really acknowledge that I was breaking it down into those steps? No. But at the same time, my brain was switched on to say, right, send the email, get onto fonts101.com and look at your logo, go meet the manufacturer. We know it's in Europe. Pretend to be a logistics person, call up this company and ask for advice. You know, so I still teased out those steps.
Logic driven.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, that's a nicer way of putting it.
No, but it is. That's why I love doing this podcast, to be honest, because I think there'd be so many people listening who know you and know your brand and they see you. We talked about earlier, but you're on the pedestal now. You're like the icon for all like aspiring founders. Whereas when it can be so overwhelming because, but I think that's why I love getting into this detail with people because when they listen to you, they go, oh, Amy's kind of like me. I've got a part-time job on a Saturday and I'm doing this. And
yeah,
it's class because like, I think that's what we need more of in Ireland as well, is this seeing these kind of like examples like you had your mum.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people don't. So it's really nice to be able to share these stories. So thanks for being so open on that. Tell me about that process though, because I'd say it wasn't easy. Tell me about like you went over to Manchester. Like, what kind of timeline are we talking until we saw like the first sculpted product?
When it came to market, we are talking about 19 months. Now, I will say that's probably not a true reflection of what was needed. It's probably a mixture of like, I didn't have a team at the time. It was just myself. I was learning everything as we went. I definitely wasn't a priority customer for them, let's be honest, because my quantities were nowhere near what they were producing for others at the time. So that was the timeline that I had, but it may not have needed to have been that long, but it was obviously circumstantial to what I was working with. But first meeting happened, got straight into formulation in the next session once they proved that obviously like I had a bit about me, I wasn't a chancer and I could actually pay the bill at the end. And that was the best part for me. Like I could have stayed in that formulation phase for the rest of my life. Like I loved it so much. Obviously I still am heavily in it, which is great. But then came the practicalities. I remember thinking about it in two very, very clear phases. I was so absorbed and obsessed with getting this product to market. So I was like, okay, this is the manufacturer, this is the label on the back. I remember putting an insert into the box of like the steps on how to do it because I wanted everything to be centered around that simplification and the education. So all these extra touch points that I thought were hugely novel at the time, which, you know, you take for granted now, but they do add an extra layer to things. But I'd say it was quite thought through. Then getting the product here, looking at storage, looking at logistics, looking at custom codes, like all of that was like a new language to me. And it was kind of just like, right, don't know it, but let's go learn it. And I'd fake a different name on an email, trying to pretend like I was trying to solve a problem so I could get an insight into how it actually lands here and all that kind of stuff.
I was going to ask you how you learned, because every like product manufacturer and D2C person I've on, they're like, it's so difficult.
It is. But I often say, the number one difference between someone who becomes an entrepreneur and someone who doesn't is the entrepreneur knows that they don't know everything, but they're not scared of that.
Mm.
The person who turns around and says, I'm not going to do it, even though they've got a great idea, is because they've psyched themselves out of all the things they don't know. No one knows everything. And actually what you'll find is people are so unbelievably willing to help. So at the time, I remember being the logistics company pretending that I was working for someone else. So I could be like, and can I just check now, if the shipment was to come from there to this port, what would that mean? Or like ringing the storage company saying, listen, I've done this for, this is my first time doing this. I have this amount of boxes. What kind of size storage think I need? Mm. They go out of their way to help you, typically anyway. Like you have to have faith in people like that. But the first phase was, like I said, obsessed with getting it here. So beyond the product, the formula, the box, the packaging, the logistics, it was looking at where I was going to service this channel-wise. And I'd always said to myself that I would go for the top five pharmacies here. I wanted omnichannel, so I built the website. Built being a very a light touch phrase here. Now, we weren't talking anything too crazy, but, you know, had a shop front and I wanted in-store simultaneously. So I'd go after the top five pharmacy channels at the time. And then my hope was that the independents would look at what they had on their shelves and then they would follow, because I physically couldn't get around to everyone. So I like basically barraged these top five pharmacy buyers, got in front of them, bombing around in my little Peugeot at the time, or Golf maybe at that stage, for like 4 or 5 months to get in front of them. And thankfully they all said yes, which is such a testament to them to support Indigenous Irish brands, because really I had no benchmark at the time of what I was going to do for them. But I'll never forget focusing on the phase two. Then I was leaving that first buyer's meeting, walking out of the store, skipping along, you know, got to show them the prototype. It was kind of like half put together because it wasn't finished. And I remember this sinking feeling of like, oh my God, I've worked so hard to make this product. And now I need to get it on that shelf and make sure it leaves that shelf. And that's when the reality of like the next phase of the project kicked in. So I had to organize like point of sale. So like the physical unit that it would sit in stores, a press drop. I did a seeding at the time, playing on our rose gold colors. I physically spray painted roses gold. So they had to be delivered in 24 hours or else they're all going to die. So that was kind of like my take on trying to like arrive with a bang at a time where press drops were common, but maybe not as frequent as we see now.
Okay.
Focusing on a launch. I did a Facebook launch.
A Facebook
Believe
launch.
It or not.
Okay.
To reveal the first product.
Had you built up a bit of a following to this point?
Very minimal. But yes. But I would say that I was still learning social. Obviously, Facebook was a bigger driver than Instagram at the time. They were definitely important to me in my freelance business, but it was by no means, I'm going to sit back and this is going to sell via my followers.
Okay.
It was like you're strapped in for the hard graft of business, which I was so excited for. But it would be really foolish of me to say that social wasn't a part of it, because it was. It was, you know.
Do you remember kind of how many followers or how much kind of a following?
I think I had about like 2,500 on Facebook.
Okay.
Maybe similar on Instagram.
Right. So like modest.
Yeah.
Something, but not not when you see like you're in the hundreds of thousands now today.
Yeah.
So like it's not, it's not like you built up this massive following and now you're like, I need a product to sell.
Yeah. Like I wouldn't have been putting up a link saying swipe up and would have been jumping for joy. Do you know the kind of thing? But at the same time, it was a very good platform that I had built a lot of my clientele on from freelancing.
Mm.
And I had a super loyal community there who were so supportive.
Yeah.
So that kind of word of mouth was one of the biggest things that helped. I would also say like sending that first press drop to the community of Irish influencers and press was brilliant. Like they were very supportive of myself going out on my own and even people I hadn't met, you know, sharing it at the time.
What does that involve for anyone who's not in the industry? Like what does a press drop involve?
Essentially trying to curate a box or whatever it might be of how you hold the product where you're sending your product for the first time to these people's homes. So it's their first impression of the brand, of the product. You're kind of taking a risk and it is costly for a new brand. Like a lot of people would hem and haw about whether to do it or not because you're taking on the cost of building the box and sending this product, like your hard earned product that you've just bought in to people without knowing if they're going to support it or not. But that's the risk. But it is definitely one of the best and lesser expensive marketing moves, provided you get the support.
It's kind of like a quid pro quo, isn't it? Like you're not sure. Totally. Maybe they will, maybe they won't. Because I think people, a lot of people can like see people online going, oh, I'm delighted, I've got a box from whoever. And they're like, how'd you get that?
Yeah.
Is this, are you going to pay it? You're not going to pay it? There's a whole like question around that now.
Yeah.
Like, so you still think it's a, is it still the same today? Do you still think it's a good way for aspiring brands to reach an audience?
Yeah, like we still do a lot of seeding. I think it's a way to reach new people. I think like one of the biggest things that every brand is always trying to do is grow their audience base. And to grow your audience base, the best way to hook someone in is to get a product in their hands. Yeah. So seeding allows you to do that. Now, is it as clean cut? No. You know, there's a lot of more like sustainability measures needed in this day and age where people are probably paring back a bit on how, I don't know, big and ambitious their sends are. And it might be a more kind of small, sustainable, curated send, which is lovely as well. The main thing you're trying to do is basically get your product into the hands of new people. Or people that you admire and that you want to hopefully get them to open the box and give it a go.
What was it like getting that first product, seeing it there and then seeing it on the shelf? Like, what was that feeling like?
It was so highly emotional and stressful. It was amazing when it landed, but not everything was right with the product when it landed. And then there was this whole surge and rush to get it to stores to make sure that I didn't let down the buyers on the date that I said I would, but actually the shipment was late. So you're dealing with all of this chaos in the background. And then you're trying to be this really put together person on email or on camera being like, yeah, it's so great. It's all arrived. I've actually been up since like 4 a.m. trying to make sure it all happens. But it was amazing. And I think, I don't think I ever really sat back and went, oh my God, like you actually made this happen. Because there was always another thing. So like I said, you go from phase one of making the product to phase two to selling the product. You go to phase three to sustaining that product and make sure the sales happen beyond Christmas. What's your next talking point? What's your next marketing move? And then I had this feeling of like, shit, I haven't thought about what my next product is. I was so geared up for these two items and the whole ethos of simplifying it and making it easier and breaking it down that I hadn't thought beyond what's my next product. And then I went, I'm really enjoying this. So I better do another one. And that's why my first year and a half to 2 years was a slower growth, because I was really just understanding what was ahead and actually what direction I wanted to take. So the next launch didn't happen till 12 months later.
Right. Was there, at what point did you think this is going to work? Or did you just, it's going to work. I'm going to will this into working.
Not just I'm going to will it into working. I was like, I was going to keep going. Why wouldn't this work? You know, it was working. It was hard, like really hard. But ultimately, I loved it and I loved the challenge. Like I used to read my notepad or kind of diary of actions at the time, because it was just after I'd finished final year. So I'd swept over to the next year diary. And I remember we were moving house and I picked it up and it was like the level of things I would do were so varied. It was like go to the post office to deliver the stock, ring the logistics to get the customs code, go on Facebook Live and do that. You know, it was like every single part of the business that needed doing. Obviously, as a one-woman band, you had to do.
You're moving it along at every single stage.
Yeah. Also, I should note when the first two products landed, they all landed into my mother's sitting room.
I love that. But that's one of my favorite things. I love that kind of like, because again, people will look at you and go, Amy's so put together and everything is so perfect. But I love especially following newer founders because they're like, this pallet just arrived and it's in their yard. Like, I love it. And I always say that to founders, like, never fake it too much. It's like, you have something big brands don't have.
Yeah.
Story.
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
Authenticity. Yeah. And now people will root for you. They're like, did you get that palette sorted?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I did. I got my mom to help me, whatever. Like, I love
Yeah,
that.
We couldn't watch TV for a week. There was about
just sculpted by Amy here everywhere.
Literally, it took us 7 carloads up to a storage unit to get them out of the house and into that storage unit, which I obviously hadn't anticipated at the time.
The novelty well wore off seeing your own product. This product. Get it sold fast. So you, I love that thing though. I just want to go back to that, targeting the top 5 pharmacies and then letting them be the, then being the kind of the arbiters of taste. What point then did you go, okay, this is working, let's do more?
I would say into the first 6 months of the product. Maybe first 4 months of the product launch.
Wow, that seems fast.
Yeah, well, it was also questions I was getting. So buyers, which is great, were like, cool, this is working. I'm not saying I was like setting off fires in store with the sales rate, but they were like, this is great. There's definitely appetite. What's the plan? So naturally, they expect when a brand comes in that there is a critical path of product to follow. And I was kind of like, let me come back to you on that.
It's R&D. R&D are all over it.
I'm just going to chat to Anne here in accounts who was just going to roll up the next PO there. And then it was like, okay, switch on here. What is it you want to do? What is possible to do in the time frame? Remember, one thing I had was, because I hadn't considered the next product, I had to launch something in that next financial year. So I had launched very late into 2016 and I needed something in 2017. Whereas obviously I quoted the time frame it took me to get the first product to market. So I definitely didn't have that amount of time in my hands. But I ended up doing a different color variation of the original palette, which was a nice, consistent kind of follow on. And people were familiar with the ethos of the palette and the doubling up and the multi-purpose benefit. And then really kind of a year and a half into it, it was like I hired my first person and I was all in here. Not that I was ever not all in, but it was like, you need to start getting your shit together now.
That's a different process and weight, and it can't all be here now anymore.
Exactly.
Is that how it works, Amy? Is it like you get in and then there's like an expectation that you're going to keep feeding new products? Is that what buyers are looking for? Is that what you're kind of under pressure as a brand to bring?
Yeah, I think the beauty industry in itself is very like that. It is so relentless and so fast paced. And the whole idea is that there is more newness added all of the time.
Right.
There needs to be news. But at the same time, when you develop yourself out enough, your core products will always be your bread and butter. But you just have like little pockets of stories that arrive in outside it. Mm-hmm. But at the beginning, yeah, like they would have expected, like they would have any brand coming in, cool, you've given us your first two products, they've done well, so what's the plan? I'm like, I don't know the plan. I'll make it.
What was the biggest challenge in the first kind of like couple of years? I know it's probably a million, pick your poison, but like
literally, how long do you have?
What was like the biggest one where you're like, oh, this is like an existential crisis, as opposed to this is going to require a bit of graft, but I'll get there.
If I, there's probably two things at the very beginning. It was probably when I was most naive and obviously most new to this as well. So I was coming in like really ready to work, but also quite green because I'd never done it before. And the first supplier I had worked with turned out to not be my supplier beyond that first launch. That was a real letdown for me. Mm. I felt it was like that first time that I was like, oh, maybe not everyone does have your back in business. And listen, they weren't terrible, but I felt that my age and, you know, being a kind of younger blonde girl at the time, I was just like, I just don't feel they're really believing in me or giving me the same level of respect as they would others. Mm. And the quality of the component wasn't right. And I was like so sick with nerves because obviously, you know, you send a product to someone, they don't like it, they're not coming back, do you know?
It's a one and done.
And I knew
situation.
That well enough, yeah, at that stage that I was so conscious to give the absolute best as anyone would be. That was a little bit disappointing for me. Now, in hindsight, it was the best thing that ever happened because I walked out that door, went to a trade show, met my South Korean supplier, flew to Seoul 3 weeks later, and still 8 or 9 years on, I WhatsApp them more nearly than my bloody husband. Do you know, like we are so close to them and we visit like once or twice a year to the lab. So great things came from it. So I always believe that situations like that will always have a purpose, a learning or a meant to be. But that was quite tough at the start because all of a sudden you've spent like 18 months with the supplier getting to know the regulations, the factories and stuff. And then that's kind of wiped because I made the choice to do so. But you're like, oh God, now I'm back to square one.
Yeah, there's the trust thing and there's, yeah, some cost fallacy as well. It's like, oh, I've invested so much time.
Yeah. And again, you're trying to keep up the pretense to buyers and everyone else that like everything is business as normal. In the background, I'm like, yeah, oh my God.
But again, there's that hint of massive action again. You just flew to Seoul.
Totally. Budasol, and in fairness, at the back of my mind, I knew the next product I was going to go into was a hybrid of skincare. I was always obsessed with how skin meets makeup and really having that good for you level to every product. Because like when I was really challenging myself starting out, outside of wanting to make it easy and presenting kits to people that would simplify it, I also was like, there's such a gap here of bringing the skincare together with makeup. So
I got you.
When I was, say, putting foundation on customers, I would often mix in a moisturizer to it. Right. And I was like, I can just create something like this. So I wanted to remove the level of steps that would be prior to your foundation, basically, and selfishly create a project for myself, but a multi-purpose primer. So without making it too complicated, a lot of people at the time would have applied their serum, their moisturizer, a primer to make their makeup stay on for longer, a bit of a glow product for a little bit of shine, and an SPF because they needed that for the day. So you're looking at 5 or 6 steps before you even get to foundation. I was someone who would skip 1 or 2 of those at the time, potentially SPF, which is detrimental to your skin. So I was like, I want to make a cream that basically brings 3 of these functions together. And it should be so easy, but it doesn't exist. So I was going to our supplier with like a dollop of moisturizer, a little bit of a glow primer and an SPF and saying, I want to mix all of these into one. So it took us a long time. But South Korean was the supplier for that. But also they are the mecca for skincare. So whilst I, you know, had my trust a little bit tainted with the previous supplier, I always knew I wanted to go further afield for my branch out into skin. So it was the best thing that ever happened.
Was it hard with the cultural differences? Like, is there major cultural differences between going, like you were going from Manchester to South Korea? Like, is there not only like the logistics and the time, is it a challenge?
I would say it's different for sure, but I wouldn't have considered it a challenge. I think we were lucky in that the main lead of the factory is half American, half South Korean. So the language barrier was never an issue. They're also the loveliest people and they have the utmost respect for us as suppliers, but also for the quality of product. So that was really evident from the get-go. Like when I first went to the factory visit, I wasn't producing anything at the time. I was just walking the floors, meeting people, you know, making sure it's all above board, certifications in place, and just getting a feel for kind of who would be behind the product making. So I think there's definitely a cultural shift, but like nothing that you would feel any different if you're just going there on holidays. Do you know? And again, the biggest thing is the language barrier. Once that wasn't a blocker, because when you're giving feedback on formulas, it's extremely intricate. Like it's like, if we could just have 0.02 less percent pearl on the, you know, if the language was an issue, it would be very hard to navigate that. But no, it was all good.
Bring me back then to, you wanted to be omnichannel. You wanted to be online, offline. How did you build them out simultaneously? Because I think building one would be tough. How did you do it simultaneously?
So I will caveat again that the website was a gentle ease into that side of the world. I don't claim to be the world's best coder and have produced, you know, the most amazing storefront. But I think the fact that I was online for my own business in the sense that I had my Facebook page, but I also had like a booking storefront for like masterclasses or makeup academies. Okay. So actually what I took was...
Were you still doing them?
Am I still doing them?
No, were you still doing them back then? Were you still?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay,
so you were simultaneously. The first 2 years, I was still doing all my tutoring and everything. We still have the academy and the brand now. Obviously, I don't get the pleasure of teaching every class anymore with the schedule, but the academy is like in my heart and soul. Mm.
So you kept it going those first 2 years on top of building the brand.
Yeah, because also at the stage, like at that time, that was the moneymaker. You know, it was like that was my income to be able to sustain the brand that was a little bit of the unknown. Obviously, you're getting sales back for product sell-ins, but like it was slow and steady and far in between. And also, you know, suppliers wouldn't be paying you exactly on the button, do you know? So I
30,
used to
60, 90.
I used to pretend because I used to find it really difficult. Like that whole, I think the payment conversation in any regard is always a challenge, but particularly as a young person coming into business, I used to hate it. And I used to have to be the relationship with the buyer on the out front, on the outside. So I would pretend to be Anne on accounts on my email. And I'd be like, hi there, this is Anne on behalf of Amy, just chasing payment. Great. And they'd all respond to Anne,
great
no problem. But that was really important to me because then I could still keep up the lovely relationship that I was hoping to keep and build to grow the brand.
That's a great hack.
Yeah.
I love that.
I know, I always tell it and people are like, oh, that's a great idea. Let's do that. Or a lot of people actually already do it in different ways as well. But yeah, so I had the kind of shop front already working for some things like that. So it was really just like a small kind of add-on or build for the brand. Like I said, I wasn't expecting huge quantities to come through the website, but I just knew that I don't know what it was. I just knew I wanted website and I wanted in-store. So like I said, my strategy of going to the top five buyers is how I approached that at the beginning, about 2 or 3 months in advance of launching, to be sure I secured the same date in November, pre-launched on Facebook via a live tutorial, and then it landed in stores the next day.
That's cool.
Yeah.
And then it's kind of interesting because you built up your own little ecosystem there. It was all, one was feeding the other. So you did the masterclasses, which would feed the product, which would feed back to... And I think there's also something interesting there for people to note, because there's this kind of like myth of entrepreneurs, like, oh yeah, go all in and risk it all. Like the good ones I talk to are like you, who have logical risk. They're like, well, I can do my masterclasses, they'll pay my wage, and then this is going to pay for the other stuff, which is going to pay. There's a real like myth among founders that it's this, they're these reckless, freewheeling, bad people who are just out there running amok. Whereas in reality, it's actually, go back to your original thing of the logic. I'll do this, which will bring this. But you also got to live. You got to eat. You got to pay for your car. So I think that's really interesting for people to know that you were doing both.
But also outside of the necessity, you know, I was selling a product that I was then teaching in another way. So at my events, I was able to offer an end result to someone that they could actually take away with them. And also being the tutor and the makeup artist, that's your level of credibility. That is why I was an expert in my field before I started the field, do you know? So it, yeah, I didn't even consider at the time that I was still continuing. It was like, well, of course I'm going to. And it was like a really tough decision for me to stop freelancing and doing people's makeup when I had to make that call.
What point did you make that call?
About 2 years into it. maybe from a year and a half, it started to really, you know, sidle out to just like bookings that I knew were like very close people or very, very regulars. But I really felt the loss of that. Now, thankfully, it came back into my life, maybe not personally, but through extension of me and the brand, when we opened our first flagship in 22. And that was the real goal, to come back to that 360 of being on counter myself and having my sculpted team on counter like I did with my own brand. That was cool.
That's a real full circle moment, isn't it? 16-year-old Amy's
so
looking ahead
ways.
Going, class.
So we launched Grafton Street September 22 when I was 29.
Was that your first?
That was our first flagship. Our first like proper big. Stores here. I was 29. I had left the Mac shop floor in Grafton Street 10 years prior to that. And we took the unit that was formerly occupied by Urban Decay. That was my first part-time brand when I was 16.
No way.
Yeah.
That's weird, isn't it?
It was wild. It's like all these stars are aligning.
The universe is funny, isn't
yeah.
it? It's kind of odd, isn't it?
Yeah.
How things like that happen. Like Colin Harmon in yesterday, and he was saying he quit his job on December 5th. And then the following December 5th, he won like World Barista Championships. The following December 5th, he opened his shop. And I'm
yeah.
like, that's weird. I was like, were you planning that? And he goes, no. He's like, I just had it up on the board. It's like, oh, I'm going to do this by this date. It's like, you know, if you do manifestation, visualization, we'll call it whatever you want, there is something powerful in the universe going on when you set your mind to things.
I think you just have to believe.
Yeah. And then massive action.
Yeah.
So that's a cool moment, isn't it? Like to see like 16-year-old Amy sees you launching your flagship on Grafton Street. That was, do you say that was always a plan?
No, it wasn't necessarily. I always probably knew in my gut that I would love to come back to that someday. But at the same time, for the first 2 or 3 years, the thought of having your own physical store is so wildly out of the realm of possibilities because you don't even have enough stock to actually fill it. And also it's such a huge investment. You're trying to make ends meet the whole time. But in saying that, it happened quite quickly into our journey versus what people I think would have expected. And I remember we were coming back after COVID. I was looking at units and I said to the team in January, going to open a store in Grafton Street this year. And everyone's like, sorry? Like stores, the high street had been closed for like 12, maybe 15 months at the time. And everyone's like, it's never coming back. And I was like, this is the right time. And whatever about the time of the pandemic, it wasn't necessarily linked to that. It was more for us as a brand. I was like, what's our level up this year? What are we doing that separates us from a very, very busy market?
Yeah.
And what do we know that we can own? So I wanted the flagship to be like this marked difference to others, but also I wanted it to be like this hub where we would do makeovers, makeup lessons, host the academy, do everything that was in like Amy's Heritage Days, but via the brand, and actually invite people in for that experience.
Yeah.
That we were so blessed to have so many brilliant retailers, and it was never to take away from them. Ironically, we actually saw a great halo effect across everything, and we still continue to see that with flagships. But I really wanted that one and done space. And there was no other location that we could have done it when we're talking about Ireland other than Grafton Street for that first one.
It's a big statement.
Yeah.
And where you are as well, people always say, oh, that's the top, that's the bottom. I always consider that the top.
Same.
I'm like, that's like that. You come off the green there and Stephen's Green's on the corner. That's kind of where I see everything happen. Yeah. Like that's if you dropped a pin in the center, I think that's where I always kind of equate as like the center point. And you're right there.
We've had some cool moments like where I've been standing on the street and like you've got people on the phone, most likely men who don't really maybe acknowledge, you know, who we are or what they're standing outside. And they're like, I'm outside the big pink shop. And I'm like, yes,
yes,
we're a landmark.
But in Irish kind of like culture, it's a big, Grafton Street is a big thing.
Yeah.
Then kind of bring me through kind of like the journey now, because like you've, the last couple of years, you've just seemed to be everywhere. You've had incredible growth. You know, it's been reported how much growth you've had, so it's quite common knowledge. But like, what's been driving that?
I think one of the biggest things that I would say to the team and to myself is that we never become complacent. So we can be grateful for the successes. We can be unbelievably excited about what's ahead, but we never become complacent. So like the day that we say, oh, we're so happy to be number one. That's great. You need to be number one tomorrow. You need to stay number one next week, next month, next year. So I think it's probably that inherent drive. I think I have a fantastic team who have come on this journey with me and continue to do so, where you know, a lot of the time you are figuring it out for the first time, because although we're a few years in business now, it has always just been myself at the top. And like I said, I'm complimented by the best team right now. But like when we're launching into a new market, I haven't done that before. But I'm like, yeah, here's the plan. Here's what we're going to do. Everyone will have great creative ideas. We're figuring out a new process for the first time, generally speaking, a lot of the time. But I think it's that will to succeed, to push on, to drive. But actually, the underlying thing in all of it is like, I am just so excited by it all. Like, I really love it. I don't see it as another, oh God, another year, what am I going to do now? It's like, great, another year, what are we going to do now?
What is 2025? That brings lovely on. What is 2025 for you?
2025 is a great year of reset. So we are going through a bit of a branding conversation at the moment. So we are looking ahead to our next kind of 7 to 10 years of growth. And we're at that kind of interesting point where we've grown so fast organically that we're just taking a bit of a step and saying, what little tweakments do we want? We have some fantastic product launches that will see us further cement in like our key categories of product. There's huge opportunity in the UK. Really not to take that for granted. There is still so much work to be done and exciting things to come there. So that is a huge focus. And then it will also see us soft launch in the US online, which is as terrifying as it is exciting.
Then talk to me about Amy.
Yeah.
Non-business Amy. How do you juggle this? That sounds like a lot. I know you love it. And every founder I've talked to is that's properly obsessed, is obsessed. But I love to talk about like the body, the business, the brain to try like give it kind of buckets of importance. How do you look after yourself? Like non business is finished. It's never finished, obviously, but like your body, your brain, how do you look after those?
I have learned loads about how I need to operate at my best, particularly in the last, I would say, 3 years. Firstly, I would say you mentioned the word juggle. Being completely honest, I don't believe there is a juggle here. I don't believe there's a balance. Like people say to me, and how do your work life, like work is my life. At the same time, I have great time with friends, with family. I am always on the go. I'll make every social event that I can. I fit it all in, I pack it in. But at the same time, I'm so driven by the business. There's so much to be done that at a certain stage of growth, it's very hard to have that work-life balance fully sorted. And I would take my hat off to anyone who does when they're sitting at the top. But it's also in my control to pull back when I need to. And I'm very aware of that now. So like I said, the last 3 years, like it's honestly so basic, but like eating more of my own meals and not eating on the go and actually looking after what nourishment I'm putting in my body. Exercising has been an absolute game changer for me.
What do you do?
So going for walks, huge fan of taking calls on walks. Did my first marathon last year.
Oh, nice. I've gotten into
running. Yeah.
What did you do?
I did the Dublin Marathon.
Nice.
Loved it. Great experience. Even just a great sense of fulfillment for yourself personally. Like you said, so much of your life revolves around the business. So much of your diary revolves around the business. Being able to say that like, yeah, I fitted those long runs in and I got it done. And then I got that done and I kept the business going. You're like, that's just deadly. So really enjoyed that. So exercising has been huge. Eating well has been huge. And I finally acknowledged that you need sleep. So I would say I'm better at that. So.
And what does your week look like? I know there's no average week for yourself, but like talk to me then in terms of like your nutrition, your diet, your sleep through the week. What does that look like?
Like you said, it can really depend on the week. So I do a lot of travel at the moment. So, you know, my week could be like one day in the office with like too many calls to actually quote on here because it's crazy. I'm basically taking a call in the bathroom. It could be me in London at a shoot. It could be an offsite with the team. It could be just doing like general brainstorming calls. It could be doing content, both for myself, for the brand. Like, could be sitting with a product team, could be actually visiting a factory. There's so much that can happen, but that's actually what I love. I've learned a lot about myself. I can't actually deal with the same schedule every day. I'm not built for it.
Okay.
I feed off people. So I enjoy the human interaction, the team planning calls, being around the energy of others. And I really enjoy the difference that happens in the week, the different days. Like that doesn't stress me out at all. If you tell me to pack a bag in an hour, no worries. I'll get it done and I'll go.
Do you thrive off that kind of action?
Totally. Yeah. To the point that like when I come off that adrenaline, I'm like, what am I doing for the whole weekend now? And John, my husband's like, we're just chilling. It's great. So there's definitely a lot of variety. So in terms of those other bits, like I've definitely learned to prioritize my exercise within that mental schedule.
Do you schedule it or how do you prioritize it?
Yeah, I would schedule at the start of the week in as much as I can. So if I know that I am, say, in London for 2 days, I'll maybe look at like a Barry's class that's on and make sure that I don't have meetings around it. Or I'm really familiar with my routine over there, so I might run around Hyde Park. And right. I know that park, I feel comfortable, I feel safe, and then I'll stay kind of in the area. Mm. Or if I look at my day and I have so many calls, I'll be like, okay, what can I take in a walk today? Because I do need to get some air and get the lungs moving. And I love that. And the team are so accustomed to me taking calls from anywhere basically now. So they love the walk and talks as well. And then in terms of food, I would obviously eat at home when I can. Eating on the go or out is a non-negotiable with my schedule, but I'm more familiar with the foods that I can tolerate and what I can't tolerate.
Right.
Now, don't get me wrong, I have the biggest sweet tooth you've ever met. I mean, tea and chocolate, I'd live off my
the rest. I was going to say, what's like you're like, if you're like, no one's around, you're like, I'm just going to treat myself.
Honestly, tea and chocolate solves everything. To the point, and everyone's like, that's fairly
standard, tea and chocolate. It's okay. Yeah,
fairly standard. Until you have 7 a day.
The quantities of it.
Then you have a chocolate bar with every cup of tea. You can't be doing that.
What's your go-to? What's your go-to chocolate?
Oh, I'm actually really not fussy. I'd welcome anything, but probably a Dairy Milk Fruit and Nut.
My wife loves fruit and nut. I don't see the appeal.
I love them.
One on their own. Either I'll eat all fruit or all nut. I can't do.
Yeah, it's funny. I don't get those psychopaths. Why can't you handle both?
I'm weird. I like just chocolate on its own, just fruit or just nuts. Weird.
Okay.
I can't have.
Oh, wow. No, we're so different.
We're going weird into my weird psychology now. We'll steer clear for that. You've built a huge brand online. What's kind of your tips, I suppose? Because I love to leave people with a couple of takeaways of kind of going, oh, yeah, that's where I am right now. You've built a really strong, authentic brand and a strong, authentic personal brand, which is doubly hard. How have you, it's going to be very hard to answer that and to pit the answer, but how have you done that? What's been your kind of guiding process in your head?
So much like my answer earlier when I said I kind of didn't have this ultimate confidence, like I'm going to do it. It was like, it'll be grand. We'll figure it out. Just go with it. I would say the building of the brand has not been a very conscious decision. To your point of it being authentic, that is literally how it's rolled out. I have never sat down on a page and said, I need to be sure that I'm coming across this way because this and this. That's not to say that we don't need to do that as we globalize now, because there's only so much of like this organic thing that comes out of you. But the biggest thing I would say to people is that word authenticity. And I think it is so transparent when you're trying to do something that is not authentic. So I think being authentic, whatever that means to you and your brand. So being true to what comes out naturally, because that's what you're going to go to on the days you're not switched on.
Yeah.
So like how you speak, you know, we would be quite an informal communicating brand. So I might just come on camera and be like, I'm knackered, let me do my makeup, instead of needing like a full studio polish set. But at the same time, if your audience is used to a full studio polish set, then stick with that, because that is your authenticity to them or the level of expectation they see or want to see. I think the other thing is consistency. I think it's not that you can't deviate and play with trends or sprinkle a little bit of pizzazz in at different times, but ultimately people should feel consistency within what they expect to see from you. So be it how you speak to them, how you show up, what kind of content you put out, if you build out a little series, I think those little pockets of consistency really help to create a loyal base that keep coming back, or they might start conversing. And community has been huge for us as we've grown, both from, say, me starting in a freelance capacity with having my own customers who were coming back the whole time for appointments. They were definitely the first group of community that supported me when I launched the product, to now having like 400,000 in the sculpted community at the moment. Nothing is possible without them. So at the same time, you're always thinking about how you're serving them.
How do you keep that engaged? Because it's the hardest thing in the world. This is episode 405, I think. And we've had, I think, 250 entrepreneurs on. Right. So even I'm thinking of like, how do we bring all that together? And I'm going to do a dinner here in a few weeks and things like that. But how do you think about keeping the community more than just a broadcast channel? Because obviously podcasts and what you do is, a lot of what we do is you broadcast out to people and go, hey, here's me and Amy. Yeah. It's just me and you.
Yeah.
And I feel like there's like a third person there listening. That's the audience. But like, we don't get to have them in the conversations. How do you do that?
I think a lot of it comes down to the different ways in which you're communicating. So it doesn't always have to be a, hey, we're getting together at this event, let's come here, because people are in different locations. Although I do really think face-to-face is huge, which is why it was a huge driver for me for flagships across London, Dublin, Kildare and Belfast, because I wanted those hubs to invite people in. But sometimes it's as simple as like making sure you're responding to comments and actually having a conversation with people. And people appreciate it, and they also acknowledge that they're speaking to a human. I am a devil for putting up like question boxes and then getting thoughts on what we're doing as a brand, what we could do better, you know, always open to critique and improving, because I think I thrive off that. Because I'm like, cool, let me take that issue and let me make it 100 times better. Or they might have ideas and I'm like, that's so cool. All your ideas are already in our plans because we are so in tune with you and our community like that. But say if I put up a question box, actually responding to people being like, oh my God, that's actually a deadly idea. Or, oh my God, I didn't know that happened. What can I do? And you're just the simple art of speaking to someone.
Okay.
Because, you know, I think community particularly is a little bit of a greenwash word. It, almost
very
like
much
how,
so. That's why I asked the question, because it's so hard. And every like marketing jumped on it there like 18 months ago. Oh, our community. And you're like, they're just your customers.
It's like the new sustainability. Yeah.
Yeah.
It is your customers, but it also, like, you can't fake a community. A community are there or they're not. They feel a part of it or they don't. How they feel a part of it is making sure they feel seen and heard and making them feel part of the journey. So if that is a face-to-face event, if it is a, what can we do better? By the way, you guys suggest this and this is what we've done. Or we often involve them in like the product process or trialing and stuff. So we do have like little things that we do the whole time. Not because we should be doing it, because it is fundamental to how we've made decisions to date.
Yeah, brilliant. I'm going to do a quick fire round.
Okay.
What book should every founder or aspiring founder read?
I really enjoyed Leaders Eat Last by Simon Sinek.
Oh yeah, he's a very good writer.
I think leadership in particular for me is something that I've really focused my own efforts on in terms of my own personal growth journey over the last year or two, because you know, you say you're CEO at the start and it's like your CEO, basically you're at the top, you're making a decision with everyone around the table. You have this idea and then it evolves and the people evolve and the team evolves. And all of a sudden, like you really have to embody whatever a CEO should be and that's relevant to your company. So leadership has been top of my mind. So I found that really good.
What's something you'd learn the hard way?
I would learn the hard way.
What's something you've had to learn the hard way?
That you are never going to keep everyone happy. And as someone, if I'm being really honest, cares a lot about what people think of them and wanting to not be the bad guy, that's really shit. Like it's hard having to make the tough decisions. And I don't believe it gets easier. But yeah, if I'm being really honest, that is definitely a trait of mine that I like people to like me. And
I think that's a brilliantly honest answer. I think everybody does, but a lot of people are like, I don't care.
Yeah.
If you say you don't care, you care.
Yeah, I do care.
What have you sacrificed for your success?
What have I sacrificed? So, honest answer, which I think is fine, but I would have a lot of stomach issues and digestion issues that I kind of block out, but does cause me a bit of a pain in the ass. That's definitely linked to stress. I refuse to acknowledge it links to stress, but they all tell me it does. So on a practical level, that in terms of sacrifice, obviously you could say I've missed some moments, some trips. I've gone early from some nights because of this. I actually don't believe that I'm in a position of sacrificing. I think I have been able, I hope my friends and family would agree, been able to keep up all those that matter to me in the grand scheme of also doing this. And they're so excited by the mission that I'm on that there's nothing but support. And they are so important to me that any downtime I have is prioritized to them. And also I feel so lucky, and that sounds so cringe, but I feel so lucky to get to do this in business. I don't believe there's a sacrifice attached to it.
And I like that. And someone only explained this to me a few weeks ago. And it's the first time I kind of properly understood it. He said, people talk about balance and balance and balance. He goes, that doesn't always, that's not real. He's like, harmony.
Yeah.
It's harmony across your life, Gary, is what you need, not balance. He's nice. Like, if you're working for yourself, you're not really going to have balance because harmony is what you want.
Yeah.
I was like, I get it now.
Love that.
Yeah, it's really good. What would you do today if it gave you 10 million euro?
Ooh, I would do a different business in some sort of tech space.
Okay. Hold on that, because I have a follow-up question in a minute on that one. Enterprise Ireland helps to support and fund a vibrant startup ecosystem, providing supports, insights, and network connections to the most ambitious Irish startups. From expert advice to raising funding, exploring opportunities in international markets, to strategic planning, Enterprise Ireland is here to support you in those important startup moments. For more information about how Enterprise Ireland can support you on your startup journey, visit enterprise-ireland.com. Enterprise Ireland, helping Irish startups go global. One. What would you... I'm going to give you 1 million euro. You can invest it in one founder or one company. Who would it be?
Interesting. I think actually in Ireland, we are so lucky with the level of talent we have. So I'm going to structure my answer on a business that I think, you know, where a million would be like unreal, which to be honest, it would be to any of us because it's huge. I have so much respect for, say, someone like an Anya Kennedy in the Smooth Company. I think she's just infectious what she's doing. And I love to see young females like that getting up and getting on and just making it amazing. I do think, though, that I would give my million to two founders, Brian and Rachel Nolan of Nobu. They're a local business to myself. They obviously have product as well, but I'm hoping this might be a bit more left field versus like who people know in the industry. I think what they're doing is amazing. They're on a total mission of like good quality food recipes. See their family out. I just love what they're doing.
Nice.
And I love to support them, and I visit them all the time in my local area, and they do the most delicious treats.
Class. Nice. If you're going to start from zero in 2024, link to our previous question, what would you do?
Outside of Sculpted.
You're starting from zero, brand new Amy, you're starting again. Sculpted has never happened. What would you do?
I would do Sculpted. I would go back on the bandwagon of Sculpted and off we go. I am building a legacy brand. I'm going nowhere. We have so much to get on with and so much exciting things ahead of us and so many markets and so many makeup bags to fill around the world. We are
great,
busy.
That's a great way of looking at it. I love Anya, by the way, to go back to that. Yeah. Huge fan of her.
She's amazing. Oh,
massive, massive fan of her. I think, but she's just who she is as well.
Yeah.
How she carries herself.
And I like my instinct was to say Anya coming into this, but then I was like, do you know what? Nobu was probably one that maybe it's not like a front facing consumer brand. Do you know that it might be nice as well to kind of give them a shout out too? But she's amazing.
What do you believe that other people will find strange or strongly disagree with?
That you physically have to succeed if you put hard work in. I know a lot of people might argue it doesn't all come down to hard work, which I get. But you cannot underestimate the impact that consistent hard work has. And if anyone thinks that you're getting in just by luck, you may as well walk back out the door. Sorry.
Love it. What's been your worst investment?
My worst investment, that is such a good question. I would say into one of our products that just wasn't inherently at the core of what we're doing. Wasn't like a huge issue to the business, which is, you know, thankful. But if we're on a mission to really simplify what multi-purpose products, it wasn't part of that. And it ultimately got discontinued.
What's been your best investment?
So on the one hand, like non-financially speaking, but like the self-investment is getting to know myself the last 3 years and how I perform at my best. So like the physical good, healthy habits have made such a difference to me in my life. The physical investment in the business, launching foundation so early. Getting into that complexion category, knowing it was such a pivotal part of me as an artist and how I wanted people to use our brand. I was told I was crazy, told it was going to sink or make our brand, but most likely sink it. And it is now our number one category still to this day. And I think it's such an important beauty product in people's routines. So if we can be famous for complexion over anything else, dream done.
What's your final piece of advice to every founder or aspiring founder listening?
My final piece of advice is more so to kind of founders who are maybe starting out. It's really easy to focus on all the things that can go wrong and all the reasons why no and all the people in the room telling you. You really have to lean into your gut in those times. And obviously there's a combination of having information, having data, knowing your marketplace, etc. But ultimately, no one else on this planet has a gut on something like you do in your business. And don't ever neglect that. Even if you hire the smartest, you get in the best, you get the most money, you inherently have that connection, be it with your customer, with your product. That's so important.
Amy, thank you so much for an absolutely brilliant chat. Where can people follow you? They probably already are. Where can people follow you or learn more about the product?
I am personally on Instagram. At amycolley_com. I have arrived onto TikTok also. And then we are at sculptedbyamy.com website, or else also on social channels.
Brilliant.
Come chat.
Amy, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.